60 years ago, Faber published John McGahern for the first time. His novel, The Barracks, is the spare, haunting tale of Elizabeth Regan dying of breast cancer, looking at her life, past and present, and trying to make sense of it all. It was McGahern's first novel in print, won him instant critical and popular acclaim, with the exception of his own father, of whom more later. McGahern, who died in 2006, would of course go on to write 6 novels, 4 short story collections and a memoir, and was a major national and international literary figure. Next Monday evening, the writers Colm Tobin and Niamh Campbell and the archivist Katrina Crowe come together online for a special discussion of The Barracks and all things McGahern. I'm delighted to be joined this evening on the line from LA by Colm Tobin. And before we come to McGahern, First of all, congratulations, Colm. You've just been awarded the prestigious Bodley Medal in Oxford. Previous recipients, people like Hilary Mantel, Zadie Smith, Kazuo Ishiguro. That's nice company to be in.
That's pretty good, yep. Yeah, no complaints about that.
I suppose that's the joy of it, to be placed in company like that, is it?
Yeah, also there's no shortlist, you know, there's no big fuss. They just write to you to tell you they're going to give it to you. And, you know, you don't have to stand in a line or wear a monkey suit or do any of those things, you know, or indeed walk away disappointed every time, you know. So that's nice.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations on it. I'm sure it will be a source of great joy. It might be something you'll be talking about in your role as Laureate for Fiction as well, I'm sure. But however, we are here tonight to talk about John McGahern and this panel discussion next Monday, which will celebrate the 60th anniversary of The Barracks. You knew John McGahern. Where did that friendship begin and what form did it take?
I interviewed him for In Dublin magazine at the time. His book of stories, High Ground, came out, which must be, I think, 1985 or 86. And I went up to his house in Leitrim, and I think I even stayed the night there that first time. And he met me at the railway station, and we found the same things funny. But more than that, I think I was really, he was a very good-humoured person, but he didn't tolerate bad books, you know. And then he loved talking about the books he loved. He was locked into the 19th century in a whole lot of ways, but he loved Yeats, and he loved certain modern novels as well. But he also loved talking about his neighbours, and he was sort of curious about Dublin, which he really didn't know at that time. His capital city was Enniskillen. I mean, he wasn't in Enniskillen, he was in Paris, or he was in the United States. Dublin just was a place he wanted to keep away from. I think he'd been very hurt by what happened in the censorship of The Dark. But he was tremendously good company. For someone whose novels are melancholy, he wasn't at all like that himself.
And you say he didn't tolerate bad books. At what point is you at that stage as a reasonably emerging novelist, at what point would you or did you share written material of your own with him?
Yeah, he asked me to show him the novel, the first novel, The South, which I did do. And, you know, he wrote to me quite a nice letter about it. It was the novel, The Master, the one about Henry James, that I got a letter from saying that books should not come out of books. Books should come out of life. And he didn't think writers should write novels about writers. And having thought that was a theory, when he read the book, he felt the same thing. He felt that the book hadn't worked. And, you know, our friendship managed to, I decided not to take offense. I realized that he was often very honest, that he did write to other people, other writers in the same vein, if he didn't like a book. And in a way, what he said, what he did say one day to me is, there are too many lies being told and I'm not joining. And therefore, you know, our friendship managed to survive a letter like that.
Well, and I suppose it says lots about you, but it says something about the nature of the man, that he had the courage to say, this is what I think. I'm not going to pretend I think anything else, or I'm not going to skirt around the issue. I suppose books coming from life leads directly into The Barracks, because you could argue in some ways that big chunks of this are a huge reflection of McGahern's own life.
Yeah, I mean, you can go into The Barracks in Coot Hall now, you can see where the book is actually set. And of course, because we have the letters now in the edition by Frank Shovlin, we'll actually see the circumstances under which the book was written. And it was written under sort of marvellous circumstances, in that he had written a first novel called The Beginning and the End of Love. A section was published in a magazine called X in London. Faber saw that extract, they asked to see the book. they turned the book down, saying it wasn't quite what they wanted, you know. And therefore, he was writing a second novel, really with a publisher waiting for it. I mean, while they turned it down, they expressed great interest. He was working as a primary teacher in Clontarf. He was living in Clontarf. He finished work at 3 o'clock every day. They were the old days, and he had long holidays. So it was a sort of an ideal time for him. When he could explore something that really did haunt him all his life, which was the early death of his mother and the sort of bullying nature of his father. But what was strange about the book is that the breast cancer isn't suffered by the first wife of the policeman, of the guard in the book. It's suffered by his second wife, so the stepmother to the children, who, of course, lived to be old, that woman did. I mean, so that you can imagine the family. First of all, reading the book, realizing that the, you know, he had moved the disease his mother died of, and he'd given it to, I suppose, a fictional character, but nonetheless the stepmother of the children, and he did, as I say, have his own stepmother.
Yeah, and he gives great agency to Elizabeth Regan in the telling of her own, because we're meeting her in that present moment of the diagnosis and the awareness that death is not too far away. But she has great agency in telling us about her, particularly about her earlier life in London.
Yes, I think he makes her into a most intelligent, sensitive and interesting person. And that while she's locked into this barracks and while she's indeed suffering from cancer, that there is a sense of her, how she notices things, how she watches things, a sort of freshness and a sense of, I suppose, real life in her, which is, I think, saves the book from being morose or melancholy, that you get a great sense. Yes, and you're absolutely right that it is the life before she came to the barracks, the life before she decided to marry, is given, I think, with, I think, a great sort of vivid thing. There's something extraordinary about the opening page and a half of the book, which it might seem, it's just simply, it's getting dark and the stepmother is there with the children and the fire's lighting and they're going to close the curtains and settle down for the night. And it looks like an ordinary domestic Irish scene. Everyone would recognise it, except if you look at every sentence, there's an image of light or darkness in every sentence. He makes it look natural, but the cumulative effect is extraordinary. It's a sort of big battle going on between light and darkness in the in that opening sort of page and a half. So it's momentous in one way, and it's domestic in another. And I think that's part of the skill of the book, which is that he makes this small life extremely interesting, almost grand in a way. She's a sort of a heroine. But at the same time, it sticks to the domestic detail.
And I was going to ask you precisely, and maybe in some ways you've answered it there, but it is that facility that he has to, as you say, he's describing the minutiae of the day, you know, the cooking of a meal or the lighting of the oil lamps, whatever it is, you know, very ordinary things. But he does it in a way that has a poeticism to it. He had written some early poetry, which never was published as far as I'm aware. Do you think that poetic sensibility makes its way into the prose, that these ordinary details have some sort of maybe metaphorical or symbolic element to them?
Oh, I think they do. What he wanted to do was infuse an ordinary element, like you described, the making of a meal, the going for a walk, the getting a bicycle, the night falling, and infuse them with much more. And doing this with not just with rhythm, which he did do, but also with an extraordinary attention to the smallest detail. He will describe the darning needle. He will describe the Sacred Heart lamp. I was going to Edinburgh once, and he said to me, you know, the one thing you must do in Edinburgh, the one thing, is in the National Gallery of Scotland, there is a painting by Velázquez called an old woman frying eggs. And just go and look at the faces. So I think painting, especially Vermeer, for example, or Velázquez, those paintings where you get an extraordinary sense of life from an ordinary face, the way someone is placed against a window, the girl reading a letter or the woman frying eggs. And I think that mattered to him, that idea of the amount of detail you could give to an ordinary life, the amount of rhythm to the sentences that somehow will lift the ordinary life into not exactly something mythical or symbolic, but something that has an extraordinary amount of resonance.
And, you know, even as you're speaking about him to me now, Colm, I'm seeing the John McGahan that I would have seen around Dublin in the later years of his life, But it's very important to remember that The Barracks was written by a young man in his early to mid-20s. He would have been at the time that this was published. And he's writing from the point of view of a woman dying of breast cancer. That was a very brave voice to take on in today's publishing world. There'd be all sorts of conversations around appropriation. Clearly not even an issue for him at that point in time. And nobody has ever spoken about his inability to write female characters.
Yes, it's interesting that at the same, more or less in the same year as Brian Moore was writing The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn. In other words, these two Irish novelists were setting about beginning their careers as writers with describing the lives of women who were effectively doomed. So yes, if that were being written now, there certainly would be an argument about it. I don't think anyone argued about it then. I think the question is that he was so haunted by what had happened to him as a child and as a young man, that by the early death of his mother, by being moved from the sort of sylvan surroundings of where his mother lived and worked, because she was a national teacher whose job was away from the barracks, so that the children lived with her, and then she died, and then they had to move into this very brutal male world of the barracks. And so I think by the time he finished his training he went to Drumcondras at St. Patrick's College, and by the time he began to be a writer, These were the things that were haunting him. He wrote about what was haunting him. And in the dark, he had attempted, I suppose, a more lavish portrait of his father and indeed of himself growing up. And this effectively is a second novel. The Dark is a rewriting of the beginning and the end of Love. So this is effectively the second novel. And in the second novel, he began to imagine a woman of great intelligence. Living in the Irish Midlands.
And The Dark have caused him all sorts of trouble, as you say, across with censorship. Before that, there had been, his father was not at all happy with the barracks, and he let him know in no uncertain terms. Was there more to it that, you know, obviously the character of the Garda sergeant here in the barracks, Sergeant Regan himself, is not particularly generous, one could say. Was there more to the father's annoyance than just that, do you think?
I have a friend who says that the biggest nightmare for any parent is to have a child who would grow up and be a novelist. You know, in other words, I remember he told me that year after Amongst Women came out, this is in the 90s, he went to visit his stepmother after many years of not seeing her. And she came to the door and looked at him and said, they used to call him Sean. There, she said to him at the door when she came to it, "There you are, Sean, still making money out of all our foibles."
Yeah, we'll tell.
And so you can see, I mean that it is an extraordinary invasion of privacy, which I think any novelist does. But in this case, everyone local would have, of course, devoured the book, and it would have been a subject of mirth. It would have been a subject of great curiosity that the sergeant's son had written a book.
Yeah, and written a book about a sergeant in a barracks.
Yeah, about a sergeant.
If we think about, you know, the period that we're speaking about here, though, as well, in terms of post-independence, etc., and the fact that we have a guard in a barracks, you know, there is a mixture here of state, the private life and the public life. There's a mixture of it in the story that he's telling us about this particular family. How political... How political is the book?
I don't think it's exactly political, but it gives a great vision of the Free State becoming the Republic and the sort of futility of being a guard up in the Midlands, where there really are no murders and there really are no great crimes going on. So you really are trying to catch people who don't have a light on their bicycle or don't have a license for their dog. So you get that immense futility. But I think he did see he thought public life in Ireland was genuinely funny. He tended sometimes to move to the Fine Gael side of things, but he certainly thought Fianna Fáil was worthy, I think, of his laughter, of his dark laughter. And he often wondered, you know, I mean, it's in Amongst Women where the father wonders, you know, about the state itself, about its sort of the sort of comic nature of the state. But yeah, it isn't as though the guard has anything much. The guards have anything much to do in the barracks.
You mean we've spoken about the kind of the domestic routine and how that fits into the how that fits, and that those tiny little details. What about a sense of place and the landscape? Yeah, we have walks and things like that that we see Elizabeth going on. How does the surrounding areas of this barracks, how does that fit into the novel and the way he tells this story?
I think that is the most important thing, that he found a landscape early on. He was a tremendous reader of Proust, and he loved the way Proust just took one small thing and made it into a landscape. And what he did then was, with this Midlands, with this flatness, with this hinterland of the River Shannon, he made his world. He very seldom moved from it. There are a few short stories set in Dublin, but in general, this was his world. And in book after book, you can almost find the same shadows, same trees, same names for characters sometimes. Mm. And the same general atmosphere of watchfulness, of quietness, and then of one individual sort of suffering under this and managing somehow to, he sort of managed to create a sensibility for his main characters, especially the women, that I think was very deep and serious. But what's amazing about this novel is that he found his landscape, and it's so carefully etched, every single detail of the lanes, of the houses, of the relationship to the river, of the whole way life was. And he never left it. That was his world. And it was there, book after book, in story after story.
The woman is very isolated within this landscape and within this barracks as well. I mean, the barracks is a place of imprisonment. That's not a very big stretch of the mind in terms of metaphor, I suppose. But the stepchildren don't bond with her at all. There are other men in there too, other young guards, and little or no threat. There's no sense of any problem in that particular area. But she is a very isolated individual. I think that's something that runs right across the novels and his characters, this sense of the lone individual. Maybe that's more of an international kind of sense to the novel than a particularly Irish sense.
Yes, I think that was what the French appreciated in the book, because it became, of course, a novel that was much appreciated in France, that was a sense of her as almost a sort of a modern figure in fiction who's utterly isolated, whose feelings are kept to herself, who's alienated from the world around her. And he would go on and do that again in a novel like The Leave-Taking. And he did that in some of the stories where the individual is completely, there's no such thing as a sort of nurturing society or even a nurturing relationship, that it is merely the self and the self in solitude. And that became one of his great subjects. And that makes him, I think, there's no point in just saying this is yes, it could be an Irish thing.
Yeah.
But he managed to make it matter in the sense that it didn't just seem like he was describing a parish. He was making the parish into the world. So he took that idea from Patrick Kavanagh, that you take the smallest place and you stick to that.
Yeah.
And you don't make large statements, because if you make the small ones properly, the small ones will matter. I remember at a conference in France where everyone was talking about politics and the North and the need for writers to engage in politics. And he intervened like a schoolmaster and said, the only thing a writer has to be careful with and think about is the writer's sentences. Watch the sentences. And that really is all you need to do. Forget the rest. And there was a sort of silence in the hall, But if you look at the barracks, that's what he's doing. Yeah. He's etching with sentences.
One final question regarding, because I mentioned that French aspect to it. The English, the London-based section where Elizabeth is looking back at the relationship with the young doctor, this young Dr. Halliday, which I suppose has a more carnal aspect to its realisation. Was he playing into, not that he'd been playing into looking for British readers or anything like that, but I suppose he was picking up on D.H. Lawrence and that style of English and British novel that was being written at that time.
Yeah, but I think he was also dealing with what a lot of Irish experience in London was. In other words, that anyone who had been in London in their 20s at this time would have had those sort of memories. Isn't as though, it wouldn't ring untrue to an Irish reader. Yeah, that's what London was like when you're in your 20s. That's what happened to so many Irish women, say, who went to London and work as nurses. That they would come back and they would have some sort of love affairs like that to talk about, or indeed not talk about.
And how do I know, Colm, that come the discussion on March the 20th at 7 p.m, you'll still have loads more to say about this novel?
I do. I mean, he was lucky. He got a great review in the Irish Independent by John D. Sheridan, who was not a literary person, you know, but it was a much respected person in Irish households because his books were funny and all that. He wouldn't be remembered now, but at the time he was a big figure. And he reviewed it in the Irish Independent, and that would have made a very big difference to the reception of the book in Ireland. So it was. He was lucky with the book. It wasn't banned, and it was well received. And it was, I mean, it's still 6 years later, it's a wonderful book. Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks for joining us this evening and for talking to us about it. That's Colm Tobin joining us from LA on this Wednesday evening. And that special webinar discussion, marking 60 years of The Barracks will take place online 7 p.m. on March the 20th. Colm Tobin, who we've just been speaking to, Katrina Crowe and Niamh Campbell. It'll be chaired by Tom Inglis and Barry Houlihan. Lots to be spoken about, I'm sure, and full details of how to be part of that on McGahernbarracks.ie. Agus muidjalor shachtan the Gaeilge an áthas sarum go bhfuil ceathair agam sa studio in ócht ó bhanna chéile chill in orach. I'm delighted that in the midst of shachtan the Gaeilge I have four of the Kilfenori band, Céile band, sitting in front of me in studio this evening. Anthony Quigney on flute, Tim Collins on concertina, Sinead Hagney on fiddle, and Sharon Howley on cello. They're going to play three tunes all rolled into one here. Club Céile and Ward's Jig, followed by a reel called The Traveller. three tunes there, Club Cailleen, Ward's Jig and The Traveller, played for us by the four members of the Tullock, the Kilfenora Cailleen Band. Oh, what an awful mistake to make. Who the Tullock Cailleen Band couldn't be with us. We were delighted the Kilfenora Cailleen Band came to be here and said, jeepers, the one word you shouldn't say when you're talking about the Kilfenora Cailleen Band. However, will you stay? Will you stay now, even though I've said that? You're going to come back and play some tunes for me later when I will have a big K stamped on my forehead to be sure that I don't do that again. So we'll talk to you later on about all of that. But let us go to my next guest. At this point, 25 years ago this Easter, the signing of the Good Friday Agreement ended most of the violence associated with the conflict in Northern Ireland, involving the main political parties, the British government and the Irish government. The negotiating process took nearly 2 years. It's the very end of those talks, all under the watchful eye of US Special Envoy Senator George Mitchell, which is the focus of a new play called Agreement, written by Belfast playwright Owen McCafferty. Agreement is a fictional account of those last few days and hours as the stakeholders try to hammer out a deal. Facing escalating violence, Mitchell has set a firm deadline and the clock is now ticking. Patrick O'Kane plays the part of Ulster Unionist Party leader at the time, David Trimble. He joins me now on the line from the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, where he is in rehearsals. At what point are you at in rehearsals actually at this stage, Paddy? Are you getting close to the end of it?
We are getting close to the end of it, Sean. Hiya, and thanks very much for having us on. We are in week four, and next week we go into technical rehearsals in advance of the first preview on Saturday, the 25th of March.
Right, so you're kind of in the mopping up stage of the rehearsal point in the rehearsal room itself. But at the point at which you knew, Patrick, that you were going to be playing David Trimble, a real-life character, an historical character, obviously, and a very well-known figure in Northern Ireland. What's the first thing you do when you know you're playing a character like that?
Panic. And then after that, you get busy doing your research. You get as much material as you can. You study YouTube and you find, you explore ways of making contact with people who knew him, who may have worked with him. And you go down all those avenues and you find out as much as you can, as you would expect. And then having done so, you learn or you realise that there's a space between the real David Trimble and the fictional David Trimble that Owen has written. And then, of course, you spend the next 4 weeks struggling to square that circle.
Yeah. And what kind of people had you spoken to in that initial rehearsal or in that initial research period?
Well, you know, I bought some books and I read extensively. I watched YouTube and then I spoke to his constitutional law advisor who worked with him during the process and to try and set up some more meetings. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to realise those. But, it got to the stage where, although I was still pursuing those conversations, I realised that it was actually going to be more confusing more of a hindrance than a help at that stage, because I had to really focus by that stage on the David Trimble that Owen had written, who has to interact with the John Hume that Owen had written and the Gerry Adams John, and so on, you know.
So, I mean, essentially, this is a fictional realization of these very, you know, delicate moments during the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement 25 years ago, and you say Owen has fictionalized this. What sort of David Trimble does he give us?
Well, you know, there is undoubtedly a burden of a duty to honour the real people, and especially now in retrospect, what are their gargantuan efforts to achieve a peace deal, imperfect and all as it was. However, it's not a verbatim piece. You know, it uses the timeline and circumstances of the final negotiations to create a work of the imagination. And in a sense, the David Trimble in Owen's play is not only David Trimble. He's a composite character. He represents the Unionist voice. He represents runs multiple unions in the same way that Hume is Hume, but he's also the character representing all nationalists, and Adams is the character representing all Republicans. That's true of Trimble as well, although the spectre of Paisley hangs large over the play, as he did over the course of the talks, you know. But so Owen's Trimble, as with all the characters, are you know, we meet them at the in at the point of the last 3 days of rehearsal, which actually turned into 4 days. So they've by this stage they've been talked themselves almost to a standstill just the very start of the play, because they're in day 10 of their 2 week talks period. So they've been done a lot of talking. They're tired. They're getting fractious. The pressure is already high at the very start, and then it goes higher and higher and higher with each passing day, you know, and each passing each passing hour, until finally, you know, they pull it out of the bag when nobody, possibly even themselves, expected that they would. You know,
that it could happen. Just, I'm going to play a clip. I'm going to play a clip that you did for us today during rehearsals. At any rate, Paddy. And I suppose we need to know there were three strands, and just to give that quickly. One strand mm-hmm. one was looking at the democratic political institutions within Northern Ireland itself. Strand two was all about the North-South relationships. And strand three, that's possibly right, the one that was most important to Trimble, you could argue, were the East-West relationships and how they might be realised. So the clip that we're going to listen to is a clip where you, as David Trimble, you, Patrick O'Kane, as David Trimble, are talking to Rufus Wright, who's playing the part of Tony Blair, who's not looking, didn't want to have any sound beds, even though he had the hand of history upon his shoulders. But here is the conversation that takes place between the two of them.
You have to talk to Hume.
No, we are in the process of discussing.
Not strand two, strand one.
We will not.
Listen, this rests on you at the moment, so think clearly here. If you're seen to be engaging on strand one, strand two will follow.
This isn't just me. I have to bring others along. A few of my frontline colleagues have already walked out.
You knew that was going to happen.
Yes.
Well then,
knowing it doesn't help. I need to be seen to be winning all the time.
That isn't going to happen. We all knew that from the start.
What we all knew doesn't matter.
Yes, it blooming does. I am your Prime Minister, and I'm advising you to do something.
I am well aware, Prime Minister.
Stop calling me that.
What?
Stop calling me Prime Minister.
I don't understand, Prime Minister.
It annoys me.
I'm sorry, but you just called yourself Prime Minister, Prime Minister.
You use it, and then you ignore me as if I wasn't your Prime Minister. I am, as your Prime Minister, advising you to do something. Talk to John Hume about his Strand 1 proposals.
I shall think about that, Prime Minister, and get back to you.
Well, don't think about it too long.
I have people to talk to. Tony.
You do that, David.
There we go. A scene from Agreement by Owen McCafferty, and it was Patrick O'Kane there playing the part of David Trimble and Rufus Wright playing the part of Tony Blair. And that gives us a sense, Paddy, I think, of the nature of the humour that Owen manages to pull out of this. I mean, in some ways, that is like a kind of yes, Prime Minister or yes, Minister type of scene. Is that yes, kind of emblematic of the play? Is that the way the play is in general, would you say?
No, it's. I mean, look. You know, at its heart, this play is a consideration of what it takes to reach an agreement. You know, any agreement. You know, the sacrifice, the compromises, the generosity that stretch people to their absolute limits. You know, and it does so in a very unsentimental way. It does so in an occasionally comedic way, and also in a way that is. That is always humane. And the comic moments, when they come, they arise out of the bizarre circumstances and the looming deadlines that they find themselves in, you know. So hopefully they cut there's a line, I think, in the play where they say, the news reader says, you couldn't make this stuff up and nobody would believe you if you did. And it kind of is true. There's another episode in the urinals between Adams and Trimble. And you think that just couldn't possibly have happened, but actually it did.
Yeah, well, maybe just because it. No, just hold on that one for a minute. This moment in the toilets between David Trimble and Gerry Adams, which they say actually happened, just flesh it out a little bit for us, if you would.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole point was that Trimble wouldn't talk directly to Adams, you know, at any point in these negotiations. You know, he refused to do so. And so when he was on a toilet break, Adams found himself in the senior annals with him, and he cracked a joke. And who knows what the motivation was or what the intention was, but however, it got a response out of David Trimble, which wasn't best pleased, shall we say. And yeah. And then, of course, what you can do in the theatre, of course, is then explore, well, that's what happened, but imagine if this had happened. And then there's another scene where you play another conversation entirely, you know. And so he plays with that, the bizarreness, and it's almost Beckettian, you know, the humour in that it arises out of the ridiculousness of the reality of the situation that they find themselves in.
Yeah, and there's
it's never cheap or opportunistic, you know.
No,
hopefully there's always a truth in it.
Yeah, because there's another point which really, I suppose, exemplified something for me. I can't remember it is who cracks the joke about the guy going in to get the loaf of bread, and he's asked, well, maybe you can tell us that one, because it's a little bit easier on the ear than maybe the other one would have been. Tell us about it, because it's the reaction to the joke that's interesting. But tell us the joke, first of all.
Yeah, so it's George Mitchell. He actually talks to the audience at this stage, you know, and he says he was reminded that he wasn't from here, and he talks about somebody told him a joke about going into
the baker.
Going into the baker and asking, "Have you got a pan loaf?" And the guy says, "No, I don't have a pan." But would you like a plane? And the guy says, "No, it's all right. I've got a bike outside." And that's a particularly Northern that's making me laugh just telling it. Yeah. That's a particularly Northern Irish thing, because you know, pan loaf and plane loaf, what you would call a batch loaf in the South, we call it plane loaf, and of course it rhymes with, you know, aeroplane.
Yeah.
So that is the joke, and of course, but I mean, the moment is about how they're, you know, classically divided by a common language, you know. So the three people who get the joke, of course, are the Northern Irish politicians.
Yeah. So John Hume,
at the moment,
John Hume, David Trimble and Gerry Adams
and
have
Gerry
a great
Adams.
Laugh. Nobody else has a clue why they're laughing.
That's it. Yeah. And then they try to explain the joke, and then, of course, it becomes even more painful and even more funny for the Northern Irish politicians. And, of course, ironically, that's a moment of connection.
Yeah,
between Trimble and Adams,
and
which
for you,
was unforeseen by both.
Yeah, and for you then, as you're originally from Northern Ireland, obviously, for you playing the part of David Trimble, what about your own, you know, personal and political baggage? Does that go to the side? Do you have to find the motivation for David Trimble and stick with that and be true to that?
Well, you have to try, don't you? But I mean, that's true of any character, isn't it? You know, so for example, if I play the Scottish King, which I have done, you know, I'm not a mass murderer, but I do my best to convince people that I am for that brief time that I'm there playing that character. And in the same way, you know, you do your best to do justice to not only the real David Trimble, but to the character that Owen has written. I mean, that's always your your aim is to, somebody said once, the actor's job is to defend their character, you know. So, and during the course of the preparations and now the rehearsals for this production, I have found myself being impressed by David Trimble that I didn't know. That I'm getting to know. I'm finding myself being impressed by the quality of his leadership, ultimately, because you know it was a big thing to do.
To
fundamentally disagree with a lot of what was going into that document, and yet have the courage to see it over the line. You know, that takes a particular type of leadership, which is going to be required all over again, unfortunately, in the near future.
And in terms of, I mean, again, possibly going back to those initial researches, you know, to what extent do you try to find the voice of David Trimble, as we would have heard him in news reports? You know, do you wear glasses to look like David Trimble? Or do you ignore all of that and just play a character called David Trimble?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's all sorts of ways of doing that, isn't there? I mean, there's definitely a nod to in the direction of the real people in terms of the visuals and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, you study the videos as well for the body language as best you can. But ultimately, it's like I said earlier, it's not a verbatim piece. So in some sense, you know, you're liberated from any sense of slavish impersonation, and you're allowed to try to capture the essence of these specific people, you know, in this specific situation. Right. So it's like, you know, we are also when you look at those videos, for example, on YouTube, you see quite poised people usually in front of a bank of microphones and cameras and stuff like that, you know, and that's their professional face.
But what
the play does is put you into the room with them when the cameras and the microphones aren't there. So actually that also liberates you to just kind of like go with the flow
and those are
the emotional
best of luck with it all, Patrick, and I'm sure that it will be quite an interesting thing to be celebrating it at, or to be playing the play at this particular point in time, 25 years on. Agreement, written by Owen McCarthy, directed by Charlotte Westheimer, and starring Patrick O'Kane as David Trimble, and a fabulous cast across all of the characters. In fact, it runs from Saturday the 25th of March through until Saturday the 22nd of April at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. lyrictheatre.co.uk. Nestled between Ennis in Listunvarna in County Clare, the village of Kilfenora will always be associated with the legendary Cayley band to which it bestows the name. Thankfully, the members have all decided to come back in and talk to me for this latter part of the programme. The band was founded all the way back in 1909. After a century as torchbearers for Cayley music, they continue to innovate and expand the horizons of traditional music. With me in studio this evening, four of the band: Anthony Quigney on flute, Tim Collins concertina, Sinead Hagney on fiddle, and Sharon Howley on cello. And I'll come to you first, Anthony, as you're the senior member of the band, I believe, at the moment.
Newly elevated. I'm not the oldest here, but
how long are you with the band?
I am 30 years with the band since a few months ago.
Yeah.
So
the Kilfenora Cayley band has had many manifestations, and it just seems to roll over year after year, decade after decade, and continue a tradition, but grow that tradition as well into something new.
Yeah, I suppose because of that longevity and the importance of keeping it alive, we feel this onus to ensure we keep it fresh as we can, and to try to innovate and to ensure that we're constantly bringing on new talent and new members as well over the years to keep it going.
Yeah. And I suppose we see that particularly in the presence of Sinead and Sharon here, who are obviously from a different generation. You're only 29 years in the band, Tim. That's why I'm coming to you second.
Yeah, I haven't got the gold card yet.
No, maybe next year. So we're going to listen to a little piece that we have from the album, in fact. This is your own composition. So tell me a little bit about Dinky Doofer.
Yeah, so I suppose, Sean, that's one of the innovations that the band have taken on, in that we incorporate traditional repertoire and also new material. So I happen to be one of the people that writes material for the band. And I'm originally from West Limerick, which I suppose musically would be a little bit different to Clare. It is dance music, but I suppose our repertoire would be very much influenced by polkas and slides. Whereas in Clare, it's the dance music is predominantly jigs and reels. So I suppose I brought a little bit of West Limerick into the band.
And is Dinky Doofer a person?
Dinky Doofer, it's not actually. It goes back to a friend of mine who many years ago, he was he's a very creative guy and is always coming up with inventions. And he used this word, "I've got a Dinky Doofer of an idea." So I just stole the idea and turned it into a selection of tunes.
Yeah, and it became your Dinky Doofer of an idea for the Kilfenora Cayley band. Let's have a listen to a little bit of it then. The Dinky Doofer Polkas. Mm-hmm. But what a lovely set of rhythms we get there in Dinky Doo for the Polkas that we were hearing there from the Kilfenora Kelly Band from their album. And Tim Collins was the composer of that particular piece. But I'm going to turn to Sharon, who's sitting just behind you there, Tim, because we can hear the low bass of the cello in there. We had Emma O'Halloran in with us last night with Sean Davey playing this new, she'll be giving the world premiere of Sean's new cello concerto tomorrow night. But to see the cello within a Kayleigh band is quite unusual, I would say, Sharon. Was it always cello and traditional music on the cello for you?
Well, I suppose having cello in a Kayleigh band, I think we're the first ever. But no, I would have played I play other instruments as well. So I learned classical cello, and then I suppose I was like, I'm from Kilfenora. I grew up in Kilfenora. Mm. I live in Kilfenora. So I was always surrounded by trad music. I was playing the fiddle. So my natural thing was to learn the tune on the fiddle and then just play it on the cello. So for me, there wasn't very much of a distinction between instruments. It was like, I know the tune on the fiddle, I'll play it on the accordion, I'll play it on the cello. You know, so that's the way how I grew up playing.
And Rosha and Gaina, Maren Gaina, that's Sinead on fiddle at all. August, Cole Tradishunta, August Cole Classical, no Cole Tradishunta Wine.
Yeah, Tradishunta Gwan, Awan, Imchosa, Dina Dusna, Cole Toriela, Tosavana, Cole Gary, Honig She, Harnash Guruan, Tereshto, Ve. Stoke Erisach de Limnach August.
Erisach de Limnach.
Yeah. August is Igmuna Vishe Gahatul, August is on Son Hosigme, Ishtakur and Gyol.
So it's always been the traditional side of the fiddle for you. Is it a very different when you were playing classical music versus the tradition, is it a very different style of bowing style of playing, or do you have to think totally differently when you come into the band then?
Yeah, I wouldn't consider myself a classical cellist. I feel like I've been excommunicated from that genre in the way I play the cello. But yeah, I mean, I play it with a traditional style, so I hold the bow slightly differently, and you know, ornaments and things like that. You know, it's a different way of playing, you know, no more than playing the fiddle, classical or traditional.
Yes.
It's just completely different way of looking at music, I suppose, as well.
That sits there on the flute as well. But the minute I look across to you, Anthony, it is the wooden flute of the traditional style that you have there.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And I think probably 99% of traditional musicians will play the wooden flute. Even, you know, I mean, the design of these instruments was the forebearers to the classical instruments of today in terms of woodwind instruments too.
How has the traditional music has grown and changed and become a whole different animal than it was 10, 15, 20? Certainly, if you go back to the beginnings of the Kilfenora Kayleigh band, it's a different animal now, traditional music, than it was back then. What are the biggest changes that you've seen in terms of the Kayleigh band and how the Kayleigh band now performs, I suppose, Tim?
Yeah, I suppose there are certain Kayleigh bands that still perform for dancing and for set dancers, and there are other bands then that are, you know, have evolved from that. They came through competition just like we did, and we did our time doing Kayleighs, and we still play Kayleighs, but also playing kind of for different types of venues, for different types of audiences now, which requires this different repertoire. It requires different instrumentation, as you see here, you know, us to draw on different sources of inspiration.
I'm guessing there'll be nobody, or will there be people dancing in the aisles and at the concert on Saturday night, isn't it? In the concert on Sunday night. Yeah.
Well, they are sit down concerts, Sean. But I suppose Irish dance music is Irish dance music, and it's quite incredible. We've gone to some of the most beautiful venues, you know, and some people just can't help but to get to their feet. And
the feet will be moving, I would guess.
Exactly, and dance. And, you know, it's lovely to see because it just shows you, you know, the power of this music.
All right. You're going to finish up by playing us out. Maybe tell me what it is and you can get your instruments ready. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say as well, along with the NCH on the Sunday night, we're also at the Kilkenny Trad Festival on the St. Patrick's night. Mm. And we're in Cork Opera House on the 18th.
Grand, that's grand. I'll give people details where they can find out all the dates and times. What are we going to hear?
So two new waltzes. The first one's called A Waltz for Chris, composed for the great Chris Droney, one of the iconic figures of traditional music, not just in County Clare, but in Irish music.
Composed by his daughter,
written by his daughter, Anne, Anne Karan, and followed by another composition from a Constantinople player, Cathain Ní Gabhán, called Sunday as well.
All right, we'll really hear those two in a minute. And let me just remind people then that Kilkenny Tradfest, St Patrick's Night this Friday, Cork Opera House the 18th, and then the National Concert Hall in Dublin this Sunday, March the 19th. You'll find out all of the details on kilfenoraceilliband.com. But I'll leave you with the music from the guys in a minute. When I tell you that the researchers for the scene were Leah Murphy and Amandine Pasadivine, Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound, and Sean Maron was the broadcast coordinator. The programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. And let's go out with the Kilfenora Ceilliband.